Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. This is the podcast with hot hosts and even hotter lit crit. Today, we're discussing The Master and Margarita, Mikhail Bulgakov's 1940 novel about Satan appearing in Moscow, upending the dysfunctional sociopolitics of Stalinist USSR, spiriting away the eponymous Margarita to host a formal ball in which the denizens of hell feast and party, and uniting Margarita with the Master, her lover, who is himself writing a novel within the novel about Pontius Pilate. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. The novel begins with a mysterious man prophesying the death of a Massalit editor. Massalit is a state-run literary apparatus. The mysterious man tells the editor how the editor will soon die as a way to convince the editor that Jesus and the devil are real. The editor dies as predicted. The editor's colleague gets himself committed to a mental health clinic after telling everyone about the mysterious man, whose entourage, rather unbelievably, includes a real beanpole motherfucker with a pince-nez called Fagut, a giant talking black cat named Behemoth, a dude whose description I can't remember and can't be bothered to look up, who goes by the name Azazello, and a red-haired witch whose name I can't remember. Anyway, the mysterious man goes by the name Voland, and over the course of the novel, it becomes clearer and clearer that Voland is most definitely the devil. He and his entourage put on a seance in which the MC is decapitated and then his head is reattached. In that same seance, Voland exposes the Muscovite's avarice with magical conjuration of money and valuables that abruptly disappear after the show. Meanwhile, the dead Massalit editor's colleague, a poet who calls himself Homeless, meets a man who calls himself the Master, while both remain committed within the mental health clinic. The Master is despairing due to the failure of his novel on Pontius Pilate and the time he has spent away from his lover, Margarita, while in the clinic. Meanwhile, Margarita, under the pretense that only someone named Margarita can qualify, is invited by Voland's entourage to serve as this year's hostess for an annual ball that Voland holds for the denizens of hell. She accepts with the promise that she will get something in return, and she becomes something like a witch, flying around naked and invisible in the moonlight on a broom. And then a bunch more stuff happens. It gets a little bit more magical realist and kind of jumbled and tessellated toward the end. It's a little bit too all over the place to summarize, really. One dude is turned into a flying pig by a special witch lotion. The Massalit editor's head is summoned, still living, to the demon party, where its soft tissue is dissolved, and Voland turns his skull into a stein. Pontius Pilate gets a chance to finally walk and talk with Jesus, and Margarita survives the trial of the ball and reunites with the Master before Voland grants them an eternity together, in an afterlife after both of them are poisoned. Throughout all of that, we get another story within this one, that which the Master wrote about Pontius Pilate and the lasting impression Jesus makes on him. So really hashed that summary. Can't read and speak at the same time, apparently, anymore. But before I jump to my questions, Patrick and I discussed this book a few years ago. That was the first time I'd read it. This is the second time, and I still like it quite a bit. I still admire it, but my feelings about it have grown a little more complex. And I'm curious, what do you two think of this novel?
Yeah, I don't know if I got this exactly. I felt a little almost like, I don't know if there was something wrong with me. I mean, it seems so well regarded and so like it's kind of had a place in the canon for a long time. And, you know, like I read things that said that a lot of people consider it to be one of the best novels ever, like full stop. And I just didn't get that. I mean, it was amusing enough, but I didn't get a lot of, I mean, it just kind of felt mostly like a lot of amusing tidbits and a lot of kind of funny chaos, you know? Like, I don't know that I can, like, there's not really any kind of conventional character work unless I'm missing something, right? The, maybe some, a little bit of Pilate, maybe, like Pilate is sketched as kind of a...
Pilate's interesting. He's interesting. He's a very cool character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see as being actually kind of a rounded character, but, you know, there's not really a, I don't know that in really anybody else, I didn't find Margarita or the Master or any of the entourage of demons or the journalists, like none of those have much complexity as character. None of them really do much, you know, none of them have any kind of like big decision, big decisive moments. And again, unless I'm being oversimplifying or unfair, thematically, I don't know that I really got, it seems like it's mainly talked about either as a satire of you know, communist Russia in the 60s or as something about religion, right? And I don't know, again, like the sections with Pilate, I guess maybe you could get some interesting theological stuff out of them that maybe I don't know enough about theology to see how they're shedding interesting ideas. I mean, I guess it kind of defamiliarizes the story of Jesus and the crucifixion in an interesting way. But I don't know that I didn't get much of a sense that the actual ideas of Christianity were being interrogated in it in any particularly notable way. And I didn't really get I'm not sure what it, when I read about what it's critiquing or satirizing about the Moscow of its time, it mostly just seems like things like, well, people get excited when you throw money into the crowd. So, haha, the avarice of, you know, the Muscovites, mm-hmm. which is like, I don't know, like that's not the, like, wow, people get excited when you throw a bunch of money at them. Like, it doesn't seem like the most compelling satire, you know? And so, yeah, I just didn't, it could be clever and funny and surprising at a line level, but it didn't cohere into much for me, and I'm honestly kind of baffled by the legacy it seems to have. And I'm 100% willing to admit that I was just having an off week or something, you know? I'm not sure, but...
I mean, just to like kind of piggyback off what you're saying, Hans, my thoughts about the novel have kind of solidified since reading it a second time. And they've solidified into like more ambivalence, which I know is a weird way of putting it, but
that's a fantastic way of putting it. They solidified into ambivalence. That's such a great, I don't know if that's quite a paradox, but it's such a great,
right.
It's true and yet still contradictory.
Right. I picked up on more of the critique of the like state control of the press. Like, to me, that seemed to be the biggest thematic thing I saw. So, you know, that theme seems to start in the first section where we go into the Master's novel and Pontius Pilate and Yeshua HaNatzri are talking, and you know, Pontius Pilate figures out that yes, he has to condemn Yeshua to death because basically he says eventually the rule of the Caesar will end, right? Like he doesn't say like I'm gonna overthrow the Caesar. He just says eventually we will all be free people, right? And this is, mm-hmm. you know, this is a no-no. You cannot say this in ancient Rome. And so there's parallels between that and how, like, the Master's novel gets screwed over by the Masalit agency. So there's all this, there is a critique of state control of the press in a variety of ways. Like, there's that main idea, like, obviously there's problems that in state control of the press, and then it's kind of interrogated or illuminated in different, like, small ways. You know, the Maslet editor dying, you know, he's kind of the first one to die is the person in control of the press. I think there is something there thematically, but as far as like an experience and characters, I'm pretty uninterested. Like we spend the most time with incidental characters or like supernatural beings who by their very nature can't change and can't really be characters, you know, Voland and Azazello and Behemoth. We spend a lot of time with them and like there's no, you know, they can't be characters. They're eternal demons. Like how, you know, like, and then like we spend very little time with the eponymous characters, who I take it are supposed to be the emotional core of the novel, but like they're not that interesting, you know, like
we have so little sense of their day-to-day interaction, right, that we get no real idea of why they're important to each other.
Right, exactly. Like it all seems very underdeveloped. And then probably my biggest gripe is that, like, the most interesting character in the entire novel, Pontius Pilate, is, like, we get him for 3 chapters, and that's it. And
yeah,
like, we don't get any development of him when he's clearly the most interesting character because he's got, like, something at stake, you know, like, is he a coward because he can't bring himself to save Yeshua? You know, like that's real conflict and tension and ground for character development. And, you know, we just don't spend enough time with him. So instead we get like Behemoth acting crazy with the cops. Like, you know, it's disappointing.
Shooting the pips out of cards,
right?
Yeah,
like he's a demon cat. Okay, he's gonna do crazy things. So yeah, like there are things to think are good about this novel, but on the whole, I'm not a huge fan, I would say. Like, and this is me saying this after reading it a second time. Even I mean, I like that we get a good like. Pontius Pilate gets an arc, kind of, where at the end, like, maybe there's a chance for him, you know? I like that aspect. It gave it some... It gave me some closure as a reader, but it still makes me want... Like, I just wish we had... I just wish we were reading the Master's novel, and we didn't know anything about the Master or Margarita. We just read... You know what I'm saying?
And in principle, I can kind of understand in principle how it might be a good tonal balance to have both aspects, right? Like to have both the kind of free associative cartoony half and the serious contemplative half.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's potential there for those two to balance into a really interesting, complex whole. And, you know, if I imagine reading a novel that was just the cartoony bits in Moscow, I would not be a fan of that. And if I imagine reading just a novel that was the Master's novel, I don't know, maybe that without the contrast of the cartoony bits, maybe that would be too slow and too solemn and too maybe the change in pace and energy to some extent helps each of the two, but they are ultimately so different and don't really have, unless again I'm missing something, like don't really have like structural, or they don't really seem to inform each other in that much of a structural or thematic way. And so it, the idea of like melding those two extremes just seems underused to me.
So going back to your question, Hans, just sort of maybe like coming at it this way, because I don't know that I disagree. Like when I first read this novel, I really, really loved it. And but I think I loved it in a kind of like very experiential kind of way. Like I even at that time, I recognized that the last quarter is pretty thin gruel. I definitely didn't like the last quarter or third this time, but I truly, truly love the Pontius Pilate sections. And I just like the kind of interplay, you know, through like the first half of the novel between like the different pieces that we're getting of the mental health clinic, of this sort of like organization of writers and storytellers who kind of like structure their stories to push state approved, you know, ideas. And I really loved it. And now reading it the second time, I'm just really aware that this book was written over the course of 12 years, kind of like in the margins with Bulgakov, from what I understand, pretty aware that it was never like going to be published in his lifetime, and it wasn't. And so it feels like something that like has like a different person at different points in his life writing it over the course of you know, the novel. And and I do admire it. I feel like I'm kind of surprised that this book exists, that it's almost like it's, you know, in 20 years it'll be 100 years old. Like it's kind of a nuts book to be, you know, from the 30s. But why is that? Why it's in the canon? Because it's like, why it's so admired? Because it seems so strange coming from that period? Or is it something else? Is it something that we're missing? Why is this?
Just to clarify my own, for some reason I was thinking this was written in the 60s. This was written in the 30s.
Yes. It was published in the 60s, heavily redacted, I believe.
Gotcha. Okay.
But no, it was written, he started writing in 1928.
Okay. Pretty
much 100 years ago.
I probably said something earlier in the podcast that's a little, I was because it was published in the 60s, I thought it was published in the immediate aftermath of his death, but it sounds like it was published decades after he died. So I do think that maybe like it has a kind of timeless quality to it. And actually, in a way, I keep thinking of it as cartoonish in a way. You know, you, Chris, in some of your notes beforehand, you compared it to a Miyazaki film. That's not a bad comparison, actually. And I think like the kind of the free association and the grotesquerie of the portion set in Moscow, that does have a, I can imagine that being, I mean, in the 30s, that would have been really, really striking, because all the things that it reminds me of are things that came along much later. And there is an inventiveness to it that is diluted a bit now because other media, you know, that kind of energy, that kind of madcap, free-flowing cartoon energy has had a different kind of apotheosis in cartoons and then turned around, and the cartoons have, like, re-influenced literature, right? And it's almost, I haven't read this stuff in decades, but it reminded me maybe a bit of how I remember Terry Pratchett feeling when I was 16.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's, you know, decades before, many decades before Terry Pratchett, obviously. So I can imagine, you know, if somebody, like reading this in the 60s, knowing it was something lost from the 30s, it would, I can imagine it kind of getting quite a profile in that way that maybe would fade over time. Or you know, it not would fade, not that the profile would fade over time, but if if you're not reading it with, if you're not reading it with the impact that it would have had on someone who was reading it in the 60s, I can see how that would, I can actually see why it would get a reputation because of that and why it would be so admired. And I don't know, I mean, I think it's not really, I guess, to Bulgakov's or the book's discredit that that doesn't have the same effect on us now. It's just, you know, some things age better than others, right? And it hasn't, because so much of what it does has kind of become a lot more present in the culture at large, it isn't as striking now without the history.
Patrick, is this novel celebrated because it was, it's just a weird novel to have been, to have come, to have been written when it was written and where it was written?
Yes. to have a bad answer. Like I think that the time in which it was written and the, like, the social context that surrounded its creation probably makes it seem very important, because it's an artifact that has survived from, you know, essentially a totalitarian, you know, as far as like free speech in the press and things like that go, you know, you're talking a totalitarian kind of state. So that, I would think that would make it seem pretty important.
And it is hard not to feel sympathetic to it on those terms.
Right, absolutely.
Something so inventive and so creative. And I mean, it does seem, I do think that, like, even if we don't really get the romance of the master and Margarita as characters, like, that does feel like something that's meaningful to him, right? It's like there's a, you get the sense that there was a way that that made him feel that he wasn't quite able to put on the page, right? So something that was done for something so creative and so inventive in some ways that was done really, you know, purely for the joy of it without the anticipation of an audience, and that did in fact survive all the forces arrayed against it and become a classic. Like, in the abstract, I feel a great deal of sympathy toward
it.
Right,
absolutely.
Happy that it exists. I just was a little underwhelmed by actually, you know, cracking the thing open. Yeah.
So then, like, and I do want to say, like, it seems to me like maybe the critique of the various critiques of Stalinist Russia that surface in the novel, I don't know enough to appreciate them. I feel like there's maybe more context, like maybe there's more detail that I'm missing, because it strikes me that the mental health clinic is like a really generous, gracious, humanist place, which is maybe a bit odd. It's not odd, but it's,
you wouldn't really find that anywhere, like, regardless of right at that time.
Exactly.
The doctor is like incredibly attentive,
right?
And I'm waiting for the shoe to drop, where like they start, you know, they put a cage on his head and start stabbing him with screws to let the demons out or something like that. But actually, like, a lot of what they do seems to be, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but it actually seems to be genuinely like, we're here to help you. Like, no, like, we believe you. Like, and really actually like trying to get someone to rest and it actually, so there's degrees, I think, of critique here, where some aspects of the society are being critiqued and not others. But I don't have that context. Yeah. I put this question in here, Patrick. My understanding is that the Soviet Union, there's something like, there's a response to religiosity that like got sort of like balled up into the, you know, the communist push, yeah, right? Like to kind of like
all the Marxist-Leninist states, you know, and maybe China was the worst of them in this respect. You know, they were very strict literalists and fundamentalists when it came to interpreting Marx. So, like, Marx offhandedly saying that, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses, you know, translates into, like, pogroms against priests and shit, you know, as Marxist-Leninists take over in these various countries.
This novel is not a Christian novel.
Right, right.
You know, like for it to criticize the functions of state that are oppressing religion, it's not adopting any kind of recognizable religious stance. It's drawing very heavily from, you know, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ and Pontius Pilate's role in that, and a kind of devil, but the devil is not, he's a brutal being, but he's not.
I kept thinking of Voland in D&D terms. Have you guys heard of like chaotic neutral, chaotic evil, chaotic good?
Oh, yeah. Alignment.
Yeah. So yeah, like I kept thinking of him in terms of D&D alignment, and he's clearly chaotic, but is he chaotic? But he's not really chaotic evil. Like he does all kind of things that are. Is he chaotic good? I don't know if this is worthwhile, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like trying to understand Voland, you know, like what are his motivations?
I was going to say, I think that Terry Pratchett, Hans, you drew that comparison, and Pratchett does this a lot, where he will line up the institutions and expose and maybe even sort of like celebrate pieces of them for what they aspire to do, but skewer them for how they fail on a like a basic level to be humanistic, to take care of people. And there is a lot of anger in Pratchett novels about these institutions. And I feel that in The Master and Margarita, and Voland feels like a Pratchett character in that way, where he would on the surface belong to the bad guys, but below that be secretly kind of humanistic. I'm not sure that Voland is that, but you were going to say something.
Well, there's just an interesting moment, if I remember right, where, I mean, the reason that the Master and Margarita get their own kind of like quasi-redemptive eternity together is, if I'm understanding it correctly, a representative of God says, hey, you know, cut these guys some slack, give them their happily ever after. And Voland kind of goes, oh, okay. And it's almost like, Voland is kind of, to some extent, in the chain of command of God, right? That he actually has to do what God tells him to. Even if God doesn't really exercise that authority very often, it is there, right? Like God can pull rank on Satan when he feels like doing so, which is not my understanding of how people usually, I mean, it's kind of a heretical arrangement, right? It's a heretical way of seeing things. And just getting back to your point that, you know, this is not a Satan who does evil that turns the stomach, right? There's never a time when any of what he does really kind of makes him repugnant or severs our sympathy. He's not really a sympathetic character, but you know, he's not you don't hope that he has something terrible happen to him. He just, I think chaotic neutral is actually a really good description of it, right? He's neither a sympathetic character nor someone who we wish to see receive a comeuppance or a punishment or to be kind of taken out of action. He just kind of you know, he makes crazy things happen, which have no particular, mostly more of a comic resonance than an emotional one. And when he's really kind of called to carpet by God, he kind of goes, yo, all right. So it's a very different sense of Satan than one would normally have. And I mean, you said, Chris, that this is not a Christian novel. And I think I had read it when I, because honestly, I did more background reading and research on this than I normally would, because I just didn't feel like I got it, you know. And it seems to be referred to sometimes as a Christian novel. And, you know, I don't know if I totally understand. Like, it uses Christian imagery, and Bulgakov may have been a man of faith in some way. But, you know, if you were to give this to an evangelical Christian, like, it's not Left Behind, right?
Right, right. Like, no. if you had and some I think, like, whack job here read it, they'd be like, Satan? He's not evil enough. Something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think that's one thing that is also probably one thing that is fairly, especially in the 30s, would have been daring and creative about it, that is now no longer striking and feels, so many things have had some version of that idea since then.
Right.
What were your favorite parts of the novel?
There's a segment where Pontius Pilate is talking to, I can't remember the character's exact title, but basically his chief of security. And the chief of security is saying, like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, man. Like, I know you told us to watch out for this Judas guy, and we tried, but I don't know. He got away from us, and he's probably dead now, and here's why I think so. And the, you know, the chief of security kind of keeps going, like, you know, I'll hand in my resignation anytime you want it. Sorry, man. And Pontius Pilate's going, no, you're good at your job. I swear you are. And then it turns out that Pilate has personally arranged to have Judas murdered. And yeah, there's the kind of subtlety of that, and the way that the portrayal of Pilate as, I don't know, he's an interesting figure, right? Because, like, the Roman Empire is in some sense, I mean, it's not the Nazis, right? But, like, it is a colonizing power, right. And it is not a totalitarian state in the same way that a lot of contemporary totalitarian states would be. But it's not a benign thing, right? And it is ultimately, a colonial police state. And the ways in which he is both appealing, sympathetic, and comfortable within that, you know, ultimately kind of evil framework is, like, there was a nuance to that that really particularly hit me in that scene. And it may be that I was just being a more perceptive reader on that day, you know, but, like, in that scene, I think, like, the nuance of how that character was laid out really struck me in a very strong way. And
but
it might be a moment that I remember later than most of the rest of the book.
What? I think there's good reason to remember that. Like, it's an excellent part, and it has like all the pilot scenes have the character ambiguity that you're really looking for, that a lot of the rest of the novel doesn't have. You know, that was my kind of response, my thought. That, you know, Pilate has his motivations, he has complex motivations, he is sympathetic, but also, you know, within a position of power, within a police state, as you said, Hans. So there's, you know, I said earlier, a lot of tension in who he is and you know, a lot of tension in wanting to see how things turn out for him that the rest of the novel doesn't really have. So I would second Hans and say that just in general the Pontius Pilate, I think my favorite chapter is probably the second one, where Yeshua and Pontius Pilate have like kind of a philosophical conversation, and you know, Pilate just sees him as like a hopeful but maybe bumbling kind of person. But he respects Yeshua's kindness, and later he compares Matthew Levi to Yeshua and says, you know, Yeshua was like a kind humanist person, but you're cruel. Like, and this is kind of the main difference between like this is why we want to know what Yeshua has to say and what he thinks, whereas Matthew Levi is kind of this he's more of a cruel kind of follower person. So yeah,
the Pontius Pilate scenes, like the very first one, I don't know if you have this experience where like you're reading something and you find yourself a few paragraphs into a kind of a flip, or you know, something has occurred and you kind of missed it, and so you go back and for me, I still actually remember the first time reading this novel. Yeshua basically confronting Pilate about his migraine and being sympathetic and being this guileless fountain of concern, of earnest concern and good advice. And there's something about the way that is all staged and written that I still, on the second read through, I found just as magical.
Yeah.
But I still remember like going back through it the first time and being like, wow, what a little magic trick this is. Yeah. Like what a gift. And it makes me like, I think I enjoyed other parts of the novel maybe more than you guys, but I actively disliked the last, you know, chunk of the book.
When you say the last chunk, like what are you referring to?
Probably like so
when Behemoth
the
gets in
ball,
a shootout.
That's yeah, pretty stupid. After the ball, everything after the ball that Margarita is the host for. So what is that? A third of the novel left?
Yeah, that is where things fall apart a little.
It just starts to kind of. It feels like it just starts to make stuff up, and I. Yeah, I really feel very mixed about it in the end.
But we do get that excellent pilot chapter that Hans was talking about in the last third.
Yes.
Which is good.
Yes. Yeah. It's a glimmer, a little fragment. Yeah, yeah. But I had a question. I thought I was reading this and I thought the Miyazaki thing occurred to me. It's very cinematic. I thought like, you know, faults and all, this is the type of book that should be read in high school. Like, I don't know that it's like, this book is not the this definitely brutal, chaotic, and strange, but I don't know that it's all that brutal, all that chaotic, or strange, or challenging. This honestly felt like a book that I would have liked to read in high school and wonder about. Should this book be assigned reading in high school?
I don't have anything against it.
I mean, I didn't really go through high school, so I don't have a great framework for.
Oh, that's right. You were in a cult.
not quite, but
But you were homeschooled, right?
I was homeschooled, right. Yeah. I mean, my high school actually was this weird hybrid where I did a, like, I was just straight homeschooled from middle school. And then high school, my diploma is from an online correspondence high school that was very, very, very bad and negligent and just the right. most bizarre sham of a school. But I also took classes for about a year and a half. I took classes for elective credit that transferred to my bizarrely bad, like I would take, you know, like a drama class at the local high school, and that would be a credit that I could apply toward my bizarrely ramshackle online correspondence high school. So I did go to high school for a year and a half, and I'd like, we'll sometimes talk about being in high school in a kind of way that makes it seem like I just went to high school in a normal way, but I never took a high school literature class or English class or writing class other than these, you know, very kind of, I don't even remember what I did to get English and writing credits in my online correspondence high school, but it certainly didn't involve reading anything or learning anything. So yeah, I don't know if I can really, I feel like this is a book that actually, I don't, this might sound like I'm casting shade on your younger self, Chris, but it's like, this is a book that I think is easier to appreciate if you haven't learned yet what novels are supposed to do. Like, I've had enough time in kind of the world of conventional good noveling that mm-hmm. I have a very strong impulse to go, well, none of these characters have any depth, and where's the decisive moment where the character makes a choice that reveals something or changes them, and these themes are pretty slight. But, you know, if you don't have that and you just want to enjoy something that is amusing and surprising in its way and has some kind of deeper moments, and that does kind of teach you, I mean, I think like being able to change gears as a reader is a key skill, right? Being able to read the cartoony bit and then recognize when the register has shifted and the nature of your attention has to change. I think that's an important skill. So there might be other things that maybe somebody who knew more would put earlier on the preference list, you know, but I think this could be actually, yeah, a good thing for a high school student to read.
I have one last hot take, and I don't know if I can't think of any other example.
We are all one mind.
Gaia is real. And I think that this book should be rewritten. Like how they do, like some movies are redone. You know, mostly people have like
the way, do you mean like the way like Julia is a rewrite of 1984 or like maybe.
Like, yeah, the IP is strong here. Like, this is fucking cool shit. We should be mining this instead of fucking, you know, Marvel. But Hans, you were going to say something.
Not quite like Julia, right? Because Julia is explicitly a critique of 1984, right. And would be, I mean, is I don't think anyone in the whole world is going to read Julia that isn't thinking about it in relationship to 1984. Right. It's less of a remake. It's more of a barnacle than a remake.
Yeah. That's a good,
what you're imagining, Chris, is a writer is a writer approaching the same things told in the same way with the same structure and arc, but just with a better sense of technique, basically, and maybe more of like a strong editorial hand.
Yes, exactly.
The way
maybe a bit more modern. Yes.
The way I think it should be rewritten is like in that Borges story where the one modern guy rewrites Don Quixote word for word as it is. That's the way it should be rewritten.
Well, yeah, I don't know. We don't do, you know, there's retellings, but there isn't like there aren't remakes of novels. You know, there's retellings of old stories. And yeah, like I'm so I so want to be fond of the pieces of this that I don't know. This is the first book, the only book that comes to mind right now where if someone, who would it be? If George Saunders said, I'm going to rewrite Master and Margarita, you know, George Saunders is, he's pretty good. Like I would be happy about that. I would read.
Who's George Saunders?
Wrote 10th of December, Pastoralia, Lincoln and the Bardo.
I haven't heard of any of that.
He's sort of,
I guess I'm,
yeah, he's like a, he's like a he's like a literary speculative fiction writer. Most of his books are collections of short stories, sort of bizarrely popular.
But like, he's popular.
I don't know why he's. Yeah, he's very That's popular. I don't know that he's not my. He's not my favorite.
He's as popular as you can be without being known to anyone who's not into literary fiction.
Yes, exactly.
But either way, I feel like a Philistine right now. Like, wanna, because I've never heard of him.
I think he's a little overrated.
Yeah, I think he's overrated. I mean, he's good, though. Like, I do.
But he's overrated.
You can let someone still think they're overrated, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's what makes it, what makes him like particularly Tool. Strange is that, like, he.
Yeah, actually,
certainly, that's actually, certainly, I agree, yeah. Yes, certainly 10,000 days forward. Yes, like George Saunders is 10,000 days forward.
Like, I like Tool a lot, but they're definitely overrated.
Yeah, and you still like, you know, Fear Inoculum. You said
so. It's
like,
all right. It's not a,
yeah, what
it's
if,
not a bad album. It's enjoyable.
Yeah. What if the literary equivalent of Tool were to say, I'm going to rewrite Master and Margarita?
I would check it out.
See? Yeah, there, yeah. That's all I was saying.
No, I get it now. Thank you for the good analogies. I get it.
Well, I think that's it, everybody.
I am so glad. You know, Chris, because you picked this, because this was the second time you had picked this to go through. I assumed that you guys both loved this book and it would, you know, you would both be swabbing its knob the whole time and I would be
the odd man out,
feeling the odd man out and feeling like the Philistine, and you'd, you know, spend the whole hour going, well, actually, and pointing out all the great stuff I had missed. And so I'm very relieved that you shared my ambivalence about it.
I feel like there's a whole category of art objects like this that seem in their pieces to be something more than what they end up being. And then like they do. And honestly, George Saunders is kind of like this. Like I don't quite understand the adoration. I do really want to like The Master and Margarita, and I genuinely love parts of it. Second time through, the honeymoon is over, and, I'm glad I'm not spending eternity, with, Master and Margarita.
I share that assessment. There are parts of it that are genuinely really good, I think. And then other parts that aren't.
So, who's next?
I think it's my turn.
H. Berger.
All right. I am choosing Omen Setter's Luck by William Gass.
Ooh. Have we done a Gass?
We have not done a Gass. Have you read any Gass, Chris?
No, I never have.
I think that he's interesting, I think, because he is someone who, I was in a used bookstore in Anacortes a couple months ago, and I happened upon a whole book devoted to explaining William Gass. And I like Gas. The Tunnel is probably one of my favorite novels ever. I'm not going to make us read The Tunnel because it's like 800 pages and I already used that credit for a while. but The Tunnel, I think for a long time I would have put in one of my, like, it, I would have put it in a personal top 10. I don't even think I have a top 10 anymore. I don't really have that relationship to books anymore. It's kind of honorary now, and like whatever was in my top 10 in 2011 is just forever in my top 10. So I guess The Tunnel's always in my top 10. I love The Tunnel, but I think that he is someone who, you know, you talk about, like, you know, there are certain authors that were incredibly praised in the Victorian era whose names we don't even hear anymore, right? And I think he's someone, my sense from reading this collection, the collection that I happened to pick up of essays about Gass's work, is that he's someone who for some period of time was regarded as one of the preeminent novelists of the 20th century, who now, I think, you know, in 20 years, I think people doing masters in English will not even know he exists, you know? Like, I don't think that I, even when we went through our master's program, I pretty much had to find him by being interested in, like, maximally difficult writing, you know, or maximally difficult fiction. And I think he is someone who was one of the great eminences and will be lost to history, tragically or otherwise. And I'm interested in reading him for the podcast in that framework. And Omen Setter's Luck is the only thing of his that is of manageable length and complexity.
Awesome. I look forward to it.
All right.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, listeners. I recommend The Master and Margarita as an experience, but go in with the expectation for, I don't know, for whatever it is you want to find there. I don't know if that makes any sense. But join us next episode for Omen Setter's Luck by William Gass. Thanks, guys.
See you later, gents.
Have a good evening.